The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity. Phaon points to a blind. The introduction. When the teachers are many, the line is confused. When laws are issued, crime is born. Though curing sickness where there is no sickness may be extreme kindness, how does going by the rule where there is a rule preclude citing a story? In the main case, Phaon pointed to a blind. The two students went at the same time and rolled up the blind alike. Phaon said, one gain, one loss. In the verse, pines are straight, brambles are crooked, cranes are tall, ducks are short. In the age of the ancient emperors, people forgot about both government and anarchy. Such peace, a hidden dragon in the abyss, such freedom, a soaring bird sheds its tether. Nothing can be done about the ancestors coming from the West. Within, gain and loss are half and half. Reeds go along with the wind, turning in the air. The boat cuts off the flow and reaches the shore. Spiritually sharp mendicants here. Observe Phaon's method. Phaon was an important teacher in the Zen tradition, in the Chan tradition in China, back in the 9th, 10th century. One of the schools of Zen developed around him and his teachings. And this is a koan that also shows up in the Gateless Gate. In a way, it's very simple. And another way, not so. And the koan is a way of sitting meditation. It's a way of engaging one's mind. It's working with language. It's how to inquire at a very deep level, using language, inquiring language, that helps a mind, the mind of the student, to go beyond thinking and ideas, which is sort of a strange idea itself, right? Because words and concepts, language is about, you know, is the stuff of language, of concepts and ideas. And so how can a question, a koan, help the student to go beyond that? That happens within their meditation. It happens within a strong state of, a deep state of concentration. It happens when the inquiry is so deep within the student that the sense of subject and object disappear. When all conjecturing and imagining and speculating about the koan drop away, and they enter into it intimately. Dogen said, when intimate language meets an intimate person, the Buddha eye sees the unseen. So the koan helps the student to see, to realize that which cannot be seen with thoughts, touched with the mind, language, and words. There are different kinds of teachings in Buddhism. There's instructional teaching. There are teachings that are very direct, which is an aspect of the Zen tradition for sure. There's illusion, right? Not pointing directly, but actually pointing to the side. You'll definitely see that in this koan in terms of the poetry, the pointer. There's use of poetry. There's all these uses of language because it's such an important part of our person, our humanity, our way of being, our way of understanding, the formation of our consciousness. But the Buddha was very clear and adamant about using language well. So often it's not used well. We see a bit of that these days. So when the pointer says, when the teachers are many, the line is confused. When laws are issued, crime is born. It said that when the Dharma is taught, when the Buddha began teaching about dukkha and liberation, suddenly there seems to be a duality between delusion and enlightenment. Suddenly, when you speak about suffering, suffering seems to get stronger. creating ways where none exist. But is it that it actually brings it out and makes it stronger, or is it just helps us to see what's already there? Sometimes students, as they begin to get into their practice more, feel like things are getting worse when they look inside of themselves, but really they're just seeing more clearly what's there. And so we have to have some courage to face what is there. I was thinking of all the efforts to rewrite history or exclude history from our history. Why? Because it makes certain people uncomfortable. Tough shit. If that's the point of life, is to not be uncomfortable, we're already done. It's not possible. We have to learn how to be uncomfortable. We have to learn how to face inconvenient truths. The Buddha said, call them sickness, old age, and death. Those are the big three we'd like to avoid. It's ridiculous. It's dangerous. It says, curing sickness where there is no sickness. You have Buddha nature, I have Buddha nature. Everyone has Buddha nature. That's our fundamental nature. The mind has all the qualities of an enlightened being. And so to cure sickness, to heal our delusion, where fundamentally there is actually no delusion, no sickness, is a measure of great compassion, the pointer says. So all teachings, practice, training is for this. But what is the sickness? Well, it's spoken of in many different ways. We can say it's the world of things, possessions, opposites, feeling insufficient, being competitive, winning, losing, having, not having. We look out on a world of things and situation. We see in what seems to be inherent division, distinctions and difference. And so when we enter into Dharma practice, in a sense, we enter in with a big stop sign. Stop. Sit. Turn your light around. Look. Where are all of these people and places and things? Where are the knots that bind us? What is it that you, what is it that's yours? We can think of the sickness as just believing that things exist in an absolute way. That's just a basic sort of the ground of it. And in that, boundaries exist. Boundaries are crossed. Conflict occurs. So what is non-duality? This kind of technical term. How is it that helping can cause harm? How is it that in hurting someone, sometimes good comes from that? How is it that someone who acts badly can still have love in their heart? How is it that someone who has love in their heart can hurt the ones they love? Are we all of one thing or all of the other? Light and darkness are a pair, we chanted this morning, like the foot before and the foot behind in walking. Implicit in that is those feet are the feet of a body, right? They're not just 2 feet out there wandering around. They're connected to something. And they move together in harmony without thinking. How does going by the rule where there is a rule preclude citing a story? So part of the teachings that exist in these more sort of non-instructional teachings is we have to find our way in. What are they saying, right? How does going by the rule, where there is a rule, preclude citing a story? There are rules based on ideas and beliefs, opinions. Some are helpful, some are not. Dharma is spoken of sometimes as a law. It's one of the meanings of Dharma. A law, but it's like a natural law. It's a rule that is really no rule. It's not fixed. It doesn't exist somewhere. It's a law that's created by no one. It has no beginning or end. It's, you can't find it in any time or place, but it works perfectly in every time and place. And our task, in a sense, as practitioners, to enter into that perfect working, to realize that we already know that. This law is the way of liberation. It's the way of Buddhas and ancestors. And so Buddhism is replete with stories, good stories. They're still stories. Even when they're stories about something that, quote, actually happened, still a story. So then the question is, are they useful? How do we put them to good use? And no story tells a complete story. No story ever tells you the whole. That's why so much of the teachings in tradition are clearly leaving you wanting. And so here, Fayon, this great teacher, one day was getting ready to give a talk and pointed to the windows. Two students jumped up, went over, and they rolled up the blinds exactly the same. And Fayon said, one gain, one loss. One has it, one does not. In the commentary, it says, an old master, Dongshan, brought this story up, and he said, how do you understand it? Speaking to his Sangha. Some say that because they didn't understand the message, they didn't really understand what Fayon was asking. They immediately went and rolled up the blind. That's their gain and loss. Some say that the one he directed understood. He actually pointed to one student. That one got up and went, but the other one just followed along. That one didn't get it. Fayon said, is it possible to understand it this way? You can't understand it this way. And it's interesting, in this koan, when people are working with it, most students will inevitably come up with all kinds of reasons why one was gain and one loss. One was mindful and the other was distracted. How do they know that? They don't know that. That doesn't say that. One distracted monk got up and the other mindful monk. That doesn't say that. Well, one was clearly enlightened and the other wasn't. Well, how do you know that? One rolled them up correctly and the other did not. You don't know that. It actually says they rolled them up alike. So it's just, you know, fascinating to see how the mind wants to fill in the gaps. To project, to imagine, to speculate. Oh, I know what's going on. The imagination tries to fill in what seems to be missing. But the koan needs to be taken with the understanding nothing is missing here. Everything the student needs to know is there. But we have to enter into it. We want to make it fill in the missing parts so now it makes sense to me. Now I get it. Which means I'm just trying to make it, force it to conform to what I need it to be so that I don't have to do anything. Right? I mean, it's sort of a basic aspect of training. I remember going out to lunch one time with my brother, who was living in LA at the time. And we went out to eat somewhere, and we're looking at the menu I ordered. He looks at the menu, and he goes, I don't want anything of this. Can you have your chef make? And then he laid out this whole meal. And he walked by and said, dude, what is this? What are you, the king? He said, it's LA. Believe in ourselves and the world to be so, we look for the world to be so. Thinking the word, this is the way the world works, we try and find our contentment in the world working this way. That's what samsara is. Keep doing the same thing. Maybe one day it will work. It always works a little bit. That's what keeps the wheel turning. It works a little bit for a while. That's why it's said that in practice, in the beginning, samsara is easy, practice is hard. As you keep going, practice gets easier, samsara gets harder and harder. Going by the rule where there is a rule, when this rule is unexamined, when it's not in accord with what's true, how is that going to work out? I was thinking of, you know, our infatuation with things, machines, technology, AI. right? I mean, we can make such amazing stuff, right? And it always does some good. I mean, that's its calling card. Look at all the good that it can do. And it does. And then what else is it? Well, we'll figure that out. We'll deal with that later. And all the while, do we actually understand ourselves? Do we understand the basic realities of things? Do we really understand how things work? Is this actually going to help? What is the problem we're trying to fix? The koan offers a door, but the student has to enter. The Dharma offers a door, but the student has to enter again and again and again and again, which means just stop, sit down, turn the light around. And so Fayan says, one has it, one has not. Well, you know what those two students and everybody else in the Zendo is thinking. Which one has it? Do I have it? So Buddhism teaches the eight worldly concerns, the eight concerns that we can spend our lives being concerned about, being infatuated, being obsessed over, worrying about happiness and suffering. I want happiness. I don't want to suffer. Fame and insignificance, right? Everybody would like to be recognized in some way. Nobody wants to be insignificant. Well, I don't know. Probably most people don't want to be. Praise and blame. Everybody likes to be praised. We don't really like to be blamed. Gain and loss. We're all about gaining. Not interested in losing. We want one, we avoid the other. But we can't keep the one we want. We can't avoid the one that we try to avoid. And then what do? For these moments of happiness, recognition, praise, success? Everything is impermanent. When we attach, everything will lead to some disappointment. And so we practice our basic capacity to be unbinding, to not attach. We all have the capacity to do that, otherwise we'd be wasting our time. We've all done that, otherwise we'd be dead already, buried beneath a mountain of our clinging. We come into practice, you know, partially buried, somewhat buried. No one has ever had unending, eternal, constant anything. And so if that's our solution, to just do whatever brings us some happiness, to do whatever will bring us a little bit of recognition or fame, to do whatever will bring praise and gain, but then at the same time we have to be doing whatever we can to avoid the suffering, the insignificance, the blame, the loss. It's a rough road. It's pretty exhausting. We often don't succeed. And even when we do, how long does it last? And all the while, these vital life energies are being devoted to what the Buddha said is a path that will never ultimately bring us peace and satisfaction. And also the clock is ticking. Time does swiftly pass by. But we can't just jettison all of that. We can't just say, well, I'm out of the world of happiness and suffering. I have nothing to do with fame and insignificance. My world has nothing, no praise or blame in it. I don't want anything to do with gain and loss. Can't. Because in the heart of each of these is something good. We should rightfully want to be happy. It's reasonable to want some recognition, to be seen, to be praised, to recognize on some level that what we're doing is okay. I mean, these are sort of probably very primitive elements that helped us to live together in clans and groups. If nobody cared about any of these things, they wouldn't be able to probably live with other people. How do we have aspirations and dreams and work towards something, gain something, accomplish something? So we can't just deny it all. That's what's so extraordinary about the Buddhist teaching on the middle way. We can't just extinguish it all, But if we just attach to it all, that doesn't help either. What is that middle path? Well, nobody's ever figured it out. It's not a figuring out kind of thing. It's an experience it in your body and mind kind of thing. Do that in your mind when something arises. Don't deny it. Don't grasp. That's the middle way in that moment. One has it and one does not. They both rolled up the blinds immediately, or the same way. So in training, we talk about letting go, about going beyond, discovering the reality that cannot be defined by gain and loss, letting the mind cease naturally, rest from that constant succeeding and failing mentality, which is a tyranny, right? When I was, you know, a musician performing music, I worked so hard towards a recital or a performance, right? Because it was what I was doing. It was my thing. It was my work. I wanted to be my career, right? And then there'd be the night of performance, you know, this big, and then there's the next one that's coming up. And so no matter what happened last night, there's the next one. So how to be a musician, how to do anything, how to love something and want to give yourself to it, but without the tyranny. And so in every moment of happiness or suffering, fame or lack of recognition, praise or blame, gain or loss, where's your mind? What world is being created in that very moment? Sometimes we're in the midst of something that we worked for and we can't even be there because we're already thinking about the next thing. Commentary says, everywhere they consider detachments from gain and loss and forgetting right and wrong to be superior. In other words, going beyond, having nothing to do with that, or realizing they're empty, being utterly free. The commentary says, but Fayan runs right into the ocean of right and wrong, the pit of gain and loss, and makes a living there. In sum, someone free of gain or loss can determine the gain and loss everywhere in the world. So how does the middle way manifest? When we free ourselves of the clutches, the tyranny of these worldly concerns, then we can move more freely in the world where these things exist. We can enjoy them and appreciate them for what they are and what they bring to our lives, but not expect them to give things they can't. We know that they're not going to last. Therefore, there's no disappointment when they pass. There's no other expectation or assumption. We know that when we embark on something, it may work out, it may not. And so we're not setting up false sort of fantastical ideas in our mind. And so here he says, Fayan runs right into the ocean of right and wrong. I mean, there's nothing... There's a great deal of subtlety in this. And in other words, it's like hitting everybody on the head. It's throwing them exactly into the pit everybody wants to be free of. Unless you're the one who's gained. Right? But then watch your back. Other people are climbing that mountain. So what is real freedom? So to try and create an imaginary world in which we don't care about anything, don't work towards anything, what a waste of a life. But to be tethered and dictated to, ruled, right, not by the outside world, but by the lack of mercy of our mind. You know, the way I've thought of this is, you know, you love to run. You're in a race, right? So you can run because you want to beat everybody else who's running that race. You want to be the first. That's a mindset. That may be a very strong motivator. You could run the race because you love to run. And you want to run your heart out. Same race. Not the same race. Hongzhi in the poem says, pines are straight, brambles are crooked, cranes are tall, ducks are short. He's just saying it like it is. Which is the correct one? The straight tree or the crooked one? The tall bird or the short one? Which is the better one? Which one has more? Which one is more deserving? In the age of the ancient emperors, people forgot about both government and anarchy. It's a way of saying that in this age, it's pointing to no longer being sort of seduced by one or the other, an absolute right, an absolute wrong, to move amidst and intermingle. I've been watching this recent Ken Burns documentary on the Revolutionary War, which is kind of extraordinary. I mean, this guy should be like, you know, a national treasure for the sort of the way he's brought history alive for so many people. And some very interesting things come out. He talks about how much he learned that he did not know about the origins of this country. And I'm learning similar things. And he's interviewing a lot of historians, and they have wonderful things to say. And one of them said, you know, this country was forged in violence from the very beginning, all the way through. Violence has been just a constant strain. Not the only thing, of course, but it's been there from the very beginning and big. And they talk a lot about how from the very beginning, enslavement of people was a part of the equation, part of what was happening, right? Part of what was being fought about, even though it wasn't so explicit yet. And somebody asked, how can a person such as Thomas Jefferson, who wrote, as Ken Burns says, the second best sentence in the English language after I love you, which is in first place. How can such a person such as Thomas Jefferson, who wrote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, all men are created equal, the second best sentence in the English language, how can that same person also have owned people as property and be unwilling to set them free, even after writing that, and fighting to declare that as a basic principle on which his country was to be formed, and he would not free those enslaved people that he owned as property, even the woman who gave him children. And that question is asked to one of the historians, and she said, this is the question that every one of us has to wrestle with. All of the contradictions that live within us, which I thought was really a beautiful way of presenting it, rather than just focusing on this one person, which is necessary, but really, do we see ourselves here? Is that the question that we're still wrestling with? The self-clinging self that puts our desires above others. And so Fayyan, trying to help us free ourselves of that tyranny, says, which one has? He goes right into the belly of the beast. He brings that right out. Which one has it? Which one does not? To be attached, we have to have a sense of self. We have to have a whole set of beliefs about what's going to bring us happiness. How are we going to get there? What's the cost that's going to have to be given? Do the ends justify the means? Very well, so be it. As a practitioner, those things still function when we begin practicing, but hopefully we're seeing now, we're watching, observing our own world of gain and loss. Hongzhi says, such peace, a hidden dragon in the abyss, such freedom, a soaring bird sheds its tethers. And the footnote to those lines says this peace, that even the Buddha's eye looking cannot see it, this freedom, even a clear gaze cannot reach it. It's not a thing, it's not something that exists, it's not a problem that can get fixed. It's not something that if we get there, we can put it in a box and keep it. It's a living thing. right? In our celebration of the 45th anniversary, I've been talking about how the monastery, like this, is not a thing, right? It's not a building. It's not any aspect of the training. It's not the teachings. It's a living thing that every day we wake up and we recreate anew for the first time what we call a monastery. If a person is a practitioner of the Dharma, every day you wake up and give life to being a practitioner of the Buddha Dharma. Nothing can be done about the ancestors coming from the West. That's pointing to a sort of a classic question within Buddhism and within Zen, which is really asking, what is the Dharma? What is the true reality of things? He's saying nothing can be done about it. Footnote says, the top beam isn't straight. And so to practice, ultimately, not to transform yourself, not to gain, not to keep from losing, but like you breathe, you just breathe. It's the most natural thing. But within gain and loss, there's half and half. And then the question is always, well, which half are you on? Which side of the fence? Which half do you have? Can you hold on to it? And so if we have a little, then it's making our peace with having little, perhaps even as we strive to have more. If we have a lot, then it's being at peace with having a lot, knowing that it's not yours, it's not you, you can't keep it. So then from a Buddhist perspective, the question would be, how can I put this to good use? How can I use this skillfully for as much of the world as is possible? Spiritually sharp mendicant, observe Fayan's method. And this is the method of great compassion that has come down to us. And Buddhism recognizes that anybody who is acting selflessly, compassionately, with loving kindness, caring, is Buddhism recognizes a bodhisattva. They don't have to be a Buddhist. The Buddhism, as I said, I think on Friday night, you know, is not really about Buddhism. It's about freeing ourselves. It's about liberation. So we use this particular vehicle. Other people can use other vehicles. Just make sure that they're true. So this method has come down to us through these compassionate beings, people who came from high and low places, wealth and poverty, those who came into practice with much learning, some with very little. Some were monastic, some were lay. But what they seemed to all share was a heart that was not at rest. They came from samsara and they were not satisfied with that. They had some deep sense, some crazy, audacious belief that there's some other way, something more. And they seem to have shared a deep faith in this path and in their capacity to engage it, to enter into it. And in doing that, they took a step. And then they took another step. And then they took another step. Nothing's really changed here. And they did so within their own times, social, economic, environmental, political disturbance. And so either parts of their world might have been burning around them. They were devoted to life and affirming life and ceasing from harm and being of benefit, trying to recognize what they could do and what they couldn't do, what they could give. And very importantly, they were willing to take responsibility for themselves, for their lives, to do what they could for others. So, you know, a lot of talk these days about our time of division. There's nothing really new about that. I guess in every time it takes its own particular form, given the time and circumstances and stuff that people have to work with, but there's nothing new about this. In that study, in this Revolutionary War, they speak of it as really a civil war. It was neighbor against neighbor, friends against friends, killing each other, fighting for an idea, a pretty good one, an idea that was so big they couldn't even put it adequately into words. All men are created equal. That left out a whole bunch of people. But in even saying that, it began a mandate, an imperative to fulfill that, to really fulfill that. And the things that, you know, the experiment that was the beginning of this country that we're still very much living in. And then the Civil War, a revolution against the commercial enslavement of human beings. And in every one of these times of great division, I mean, think about that. Think about it, that your front yard is a battleground. You wake up to the sounds of gunshot and cannon fire. So this thing about dividing ourselves from others, it's not new. Maybe it's the first story, I don't know. And we're still trying to work it out. And it seems that every time there's movement forward, there's pushback. Kind of like when you're sitting and your mind gets settled, and there's pushback against that. We enter into states of stillness, and then we get nervous and anxious, and we get ourselves agitated again. We're not used to being silent. We're not used to being still. We're not used to being at peace. It frightens us. But in Zazen, it's okay. You can hold that. You don't actually have to do anything. Don't do anything. Let that settle. Get used to that. Find your comfort there. Isn't what we're seeing that when we don't attend to the consequences of past actions, they just keep arising? That's what Buddhist practice brings our keen attention to. Paying attention and attending to what needs to be taken care of. When in the Buddha's time, when people would realize himself, he said this person did what needed to be done. It helps us to step into our lives and live as a Buddha, which just means an awake, caring, compassionate, responsible, alive being. So through all of the history of this, there have always been those who had faith in and sought a path. We speak of the Eightfold Path, but a way to think, to understand, to speak, to act in a way that brings forth kindness in times of hatred, compassion in times of violence, patience in times of blame, generosity in times of greed, clarity in times of confusion, selflessness in times of selfishness. I mean, that's really just practicing the precepts. It's being a practitioner. In a way, it's very simple. In the way, it's revolutionary. It's monumental. It's what is needed. It's what we can do. It's what we are, really. It's the stuff we're made of, if we'll allow. And so practice is really allowing us to get out of our own way, to allow us to be what we seek. And to realize all along we are that person. Everybody is, actually. So having inherited the wisdom and the delusion of our ancestors, where do we find today? I was looking back over this koan that I gave a talk on quite a number of years ago, and I gave it on the July 4th. And I wrote a poem that I thought might still bear itself today. For those of you who were here for the weekend, thank you for bringing your enthusiasm and your eagerness to just jump in. You know, it's really wonderful when folks come in and never been here before and maybe never practiced before and have enough faith or eagerness or desperation, that can work too. To just jump in, see, right? Be reckless for a few hours. See what happens. So thank you for coming and being here, and we'll always have a seat here for you if you'd like to find your way back. We hold these truths to be self-evident. When in the course of human events, oh, say, can you see? The words and actions of before now belong to you and me. Medicine and sickness, majesty and tragedy, these are the bloodlines passed down to now. They belong to you now and to me. And all the while, in the ancient pine grove, a strong wind blows, rousing those who would sleep in this time of great turning. May we wake up.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.